I would like you this morning, if you would, to please take your Old Testaments out and turn them to the book of Ecclesiastes. Not long ago, a country singer named Faith Hill had a song out called The Secret to Life. These two gentlemen were drinking at a bar, discussing the unfortunate positions of each of them in their life. And according to the bartender, who was, I guess, wiser than those two, told him the secret of life is that there ain't no secret at all. Mrs. Hill's conclusion of her song was, life's secret is whatever you make of it. It just happens. If you look for it, you cannot find it. While it was very catchy and it was a number one hit and very popular in our culture, the concept is pure and ultimately false. Since the beginning of time, when man was created upon this earth by a loving and kind God, there's a question that has plagued him throughout his existence. It began with Adam, and it continues on through life and will always plague man. The question is, what is the secret and the meaning of life? In this world, that is often difficult to figure out by the way things go in our life. Man needs to answer this vital question, but he needs an honest and forthright answer. He needs to be able to have security and understanding that his answer is correct. How do we survive? How do we have the assurance that we need as we go through the life? God does not run away from this difficult question, nor does he leave man in the dark about the tough questions that he must come to grips with in his life and his existence. God answers this difficult question, and it can be answered and it can be summarized, all of it, in the book of Ecclesiastes. This answer will be given. The theme of the book of Ecclesiastes is, what is the chief good and the purpose in life? The author of this book is the same book, author of the man that we just got done studying, Solomon. Solomon wrote this book, and he is the author of the book. The word Ecclesiastes simply means preacher. It means a public speaker or one who calls an assembly. Part of the Greek word that we get the word church from, ekklesia, is in the word preacher in the Hebrew here in the book of Ecclesiastes. Why was Solomon the best possible person to write the contents of this book? His great wisdom, his great wealth, the building projects that he undertook, the authority that he had as a king, and it gave him an unparalleled opportunity. It gave him an unparalleled existence where he could search the meaning of life from everything from the human perspective. Everything that life had to offer, Solomon was able to test it. We need to understand in this book, Solomon explores, is life meaning found in seeking human wisdom, in pleasure, in building projects, in his labor of life? Can man find true happiness? Can he understand his purpose? Can he understand the meaning of life by all the things that he sees, he can touch, and that he can do and he can build? Will he find the meaning of life in all these things? Solomon wants to know the answer to that question. In his own pursuit, by experience, by personal observation, and with reasoning, he seeks to give us an answer to our question. Remember, he was the king of Israel. He had received wisdom from God. When he was but a young child, he was chosen to take the place of his father, David. And he was chosen, and God asked him in 1 Kings chapter 3, what one thing do you desire? Whatever you want, I will give you. And in 1 Kings chapter 3, beginning in verse 7 through 11, he says that I need wisdom. I need wisdom that I might be able to discern between good and evil, that I might be able to lead this greater people, for I am but a child. And God was so pleased with what Solomon asked for that he gave him all the other things that he did not ask for. He gave him power. He gave him respect. He gave him wealth beyond his wildest imagination. He became the wealthiest man that was on the face of the earth at the time. His wisdom surpassed any that were before him or any that came after him. Solomon had an unparalleled advantage of life. And he could look at it from a perspective that many of us will never be able to attain, but Solomon was. And this book is a reflection of what he saw at the end of his quest. This book was written after Solomon had tried to find the meaning of life in all the things that the world had to offer. He came to a conclusion. That conclusion is written in the book of Ecclesiastes. But we want to begin that this book has two main themes. These two main themes in the search for the meaning of life can first of all be found. Turn to Ecclesiastes 1 and look at verse number 3. That should be 3 and not 13. What profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? This is his proposition. What profit, what gain, what advantage is there for man from all of his labor which he toils under the sun? And then, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and in verse number 3, he wrote it this way. I search in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of his life. And so with these two thoughts, he's going to come to an answer. What does it profit man for all the things that he does and labors under the sun? What good is it for the sons of men to do all the things that he does under the sun? What is the answer to those thoughts and questions that he gives us in this book? These questions will be answered. Let all other books in the Bible, the ultimate goal of this book is no different than any of the other 65 books. This book's goal is the same, to put things in their proper perspective. And that perspective is simply this. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it would be evil. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13 and 14. Yes, the main theme of the book is not that the world and its pursuits is the meaning of life. The writer tries to convince us that life, which leads one to heaven, also holds happiness, fulfillment, and peacement and content by understanding the value and the true value of the things in life. Bottom line, any life that leaves God out of the equation will never find the true meaning to life. There can be no answer. There can be no assuring. There can be no contentment. There can be no real happiness on earth if God is left out of the equation. Then you and I will not find the true meaning in life. How does he go about setting this answer for us to understand? He does it by 13 propositions. In this book, he's going to give 13 propositions and how he's going to show that life in and of itself does not give man true meaning and happiness. The first thing that he does, the first vanity that he talks about, is the cycle of life. He talks about how life just seems to be the same all the time. Man goes to bed, he gets up, he eats, he goes to bed, he gets up, goes to work, comes home, rests, gets up. It seems to be a monotonous, continual cycle of life. And he doesn't believe that there's any happiness or true meaning of life in that. That's the first vanity that we're going to discuss. He goes on to say that evil remains, even though man is powerful, even though man is knowledgeable, even though he gains great wisdom, and even though he can attain to great things, evil still exists. Even with all of his ability and all the ability that man has, he can't do anything about the evil problem. It still remains. That perplexes Solomon. He goes on to his third vanity to say pleasure ends in emptiness. When man's pursuit is pleasure with no restraint. Pleasure just seeks at anything that he can do that pleases him physically. If that's what his pursuit is, Solomon says that it ends in emptiness. We'll talk about that. He goes on in these propositions to say that riches and achievement, they do not bring what they promise. They give no enduring satisfaction. They give us temporal satisfaction. We're happy for a while, but then we become dissatisfied. That was his conclusion. Then he goes on to say, in chapter 2, verse 12 through 26, that wisdom, madness, and folly, all of those things, they come to the same end. Whether a man follows human wisdom, whether he follows madness, or whether he follows folly, all of them will lead him to the same inevitable conclusion. So he believes the answer is not found in that. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 1 through 22, he talks about the seasons of life, and we'll talk about that. He talks about there's a time for this and there's a time for that. He contrasts some things, and it just seems like a cycle that man cannot stop by his own accord. In chapter 4, verse 1 through 16, he talks about oppression. Man has to deal with oppression and inequities of life, things that do not seem fair, things that seem that man's at a disadvantage because of what life does to him. He believes that gives him a perplexion of the true meaning of life. He talks in chapter 5, verse 1 through 20, about false religion and hoarded riches, one that's just storing up for the future, one that's trying to get as much as he can and keep it for as long as he can. He says that has proven also to be vanity. The ninth proposition in chapter 6, 1 through 12, is rich and poor, no matter what their lot in life, they all end up the same. Whether a man is rich, whether a man is poor, in the end, they both come to the same ending. He believes there's no meaning in that. The tenth proposition, wickedness is in society. In chapter 7, verse 1 through 29, the preponderance of wickedness in society. Solomon contrasts the negative and the positive qualities of experience of life in the human drama. Though it seems life is sometimes stacked against us, keeping one's head and placing confidence and trust in God will get him through the unevenness. In chapter 8, verse 1 through 17, he talks about the mysteries of God's providence. This is a subject that man does not understand, neither does he acknowledge the truthness of God's providence. And we are going to look at it a little bit in the book of Ecclesiastes, but later on, Lord willing, in the future, we're going to do a very detailed series in the subject of God's providence. It is real. How does it work? How does it work, and what does it mean to us in life? There's a mystery of this providence, and he talks about it very briefly in chapter number 8. And then, in chapter 9, in verse 1 through 18, he talks about man's inability to be able to fathom the complexities of the moral government in this world. How the wicked seem to get more wicked, the poor get poorer, the richer get richer, and the government seems to be against him instead of for him. Job had this same question, and he wrestled with it also. We wrestle with it today. And the last proposition that he makes in this book, the 13th proposition, is anarchy in the world. Anarchy in the world. Kings are sometimes overbearing. Fools sometimes become rulers, and their folly is set in great dignity. Sometimes children, though unqualified, become rulers and surround themselves with evil men who oppress the public. Careful of criticism coming to the ears of those in power, for they have the ability to turn you back if you should criticize. In all of these 13 propositions, Solomon is laying a foundation that if life is all that we look for, if life is in the pursuit of the things in this world, we will come up empty. It will profit us absolutely nothing. If all our aim here is for what we can get here, if all our aim here is to do what I want, at when I want, how I want, and not regard to anybody, even myself, if that's what my purpose and aim in life is, I am of most men miserable. Solomon says it does not give us the meaning to life. Now, how's he going to answer this question? Let's talk first about the repetition of life. Turn to chapter number 1 of the book of Ecclesiastes. And notice the second verse. It says, vanities of vanities, says the preacher, vanities of vanities, all is vanity. Now that word vanity you have to understand because it's going to be used throughout this book. The word vanity is lack of worth, emptiness, futile, or unprofitable. What is Solomon's initial conclusion in the beginning of the book? He says, all is vanity. Now I want you to turn just ahead for a minute to chapter 12. And I want you to look at verse 8. Now this is towards the end of the book. Vanities of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. Solomon never changes his conclusion. After he lays down all the propositions, after he's laid everything down that he's learned by experience, by what he's learned at observation, he does not change his conclusion. He believes all is vanity and all is unprofitable. Another term that's going to be used throughout this book that me and Brother Sellers will be talking about is vexation of spirit. What does that mean, vexation of spirit? It's a constant, unsatisfying seeking of something that cannot be obtained. We put it in another way. Striving after wind. You can see wind. You see the movements of it. Can you catch it in a bottle? Can you grab it in your hand? No, you can't do that, can you? Well, that's vexation of spirit. And he's going to list many things in life that are vexation of spirit. Striving after the wind because we're trying to catch something that cannot be caught. And then profit is gain. Is gain. It is something over and above what you put into it. I want you to read, understand this definition of profit. Is gain, it is something that is over and above what you put into it. Is everything I put in life going to give me out what I want? In and of itself. Am I going to get out more than I put into it? That's the proposition. Let's see if we can answer that question by the end of the book. He begins this argument in chapter 1 by the repetition in the cycle of life. Notice in verse number 4, it talks about the generations. It says generations come and generations pass away. One generation passes away, but another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. So, you see, one generation comes and does its thing, and then it dies. And another generation takes over. And it just seems to be a continuing cycle of life. And Solomon can't see any profit in that. He goes on to say that the sun rises and the sun sets. The sun also rises, the sun goes down. It hastens to the place where it arose. Sun came up today, it will set tonight, it will come up tomorrow, it will set the next day. We should add to that if the Lord wills. But as long as life exists, will this not happen? Will not the sun come up? The sun set? Will that just be a continuing cycle as long as God lets life continue? Absolutely. Absolutely. He goes on to say the wind blows and then it returns. The wind goes toward the south, turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. It just seems to go in a circle. Doesn't seem to have any course. Doesn't seem to have any direction. Just goes where it wants and then it ends up right back where it started. Then he talks about the rivers. He says the rivers keep on flowing, but the oceans are not filled. He says all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full to the place from the rivers come and they return again. Now all these things are repetition in life. One generation comes and goes. The sun rises and sets. The wind blows and returns. The water flows into the sea and the sea is not filled. These are continuing, repetitious cycles of life. Why are they so? Because God put them into motion. Life seems like a carousel. Lots of noise, but no progress. Viewed from the under the sun, it's depressing and it's demoralizing. Viewed from above, the sun reflects God's order and control of the work. It depends on your perspective. If you look at it from a human standpoint, it seems like it's a carousel. You look at it from God's vantage point, it looks like design and purpose and continuity because God made it that way. It all comes to how you're looking at it. Human wisdom will never understand life. It only observes the monotony of it. We just see the monotonous of life. We don't really understand it. How do I know that? Look at verse number 8. All things are full of labor. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. You know what that means? There's nothing new under the sun. What's been done now has been done before. And what will be done today will be done tomorrow. They may have a new dress, they may have a new name, but it's all the same. There's nothing new under the sun. You know, we think sometimes that man thinks up evil that he's come up with and nobody else has come up with. Not so. What's been done in the past will be done in the future. What's been done in the future will be done today. It's a monotonous cycle. Verse 10 says, is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before. Is there some new thing under the sun? Isn't that in Acts chapter 17? Isn't that what the people of that day were looking? They were always interested in something new, always wanting to listen to something that was different. Are people like that today? Are people craving of something different, something from a different perspective, something with a new view? The answer is there is nothing new. There is nothing new. It's all the same because God has created it that way. It goes on to say in verse 11, there is no remembrance of the former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. Now, if you read these first 11 verses, you know what it sounds like? It sounds like it's dull. It sounds like this life is nothing, and it's just a boring, demoralizing existence. And you know what? If that's your perspective, that's exactly what it is. If I look at it from the human concept alone, if I view life from the human standpoint alone, it is a carousel that has no profit, makes a lot of noise, but has no purpose whatsoever. If I look at it only from the human vantage point, if that's all I'm looking at it, if that's the only way I'm going to look at life, it's from this repetition cycle and from the human viewpoint, then yes, life just seems to be a carousel of making a lot of noise, but really no profit. How can I make life mean more than that? Get God into the equation. Get God into the equation, and this vantage point will cease. This cycle and depression will cease. This demoralizing attitude will not be what you focus on. But if I'm going to look at the physical advantage, you're always going to be disillusioned. Now, he has talked about something else, too, in the first chapter. Now, this sounds a little odd to us. The grief of wisdom. Now, didn't we just get done talking about that in Proverbs? Didn't we talk about the need for wisdom? Didn't we do a great deal of time spending the need to get wisdom and gain wisdom in our life? But Solomon says it's a grief. Well, how can that be? Look at verse number 12. It says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all that is done under the heavens. This grievous task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping after the wind. What's Solomon saying? Solomon was unable to find the life's ultimate fulfillment by human wisdom. Solomon used all the resources that were known to him. He was in a unique position to be able to do so. He was wealthy. He was wise. He was in authority. He was a king. He had the ability to gain all of the advantages that life could offer. He could do this better than anyone before him. He sought the answers in wisdom. Sadly, he had misused the wonderful gift that God had given him. He was given great wisdom, but he did not use it. He was given great understanding, but he did not make application. And therefore, it did not profit him. You know, you can have all the knowledge in the world, but if you do not use it, it's absolutely worthless. You can know the Bible from front to the back. You can know the Bible, you can quote it by heart, and you can quote chapter upon chapter. But if you don't know what it means in your life, if you don't know how to apply it, if you just look at it from a human vantage point, it's absolutely worthless. It's words in a book. But you know what? The Bible is not words in a book. But it can be if I just read it. And I try to attain my understanding of God from a human vantage point. Then the Bible is nothing more than words in a book. And it profits you nothing. Human wisdom cannot satisfy. Search was labeled as grievous and sore travail. It will always end up in the wrong because we are looking in the wrong place. You know what? Most people end up in the wrong place because they went to the wrong place. Some people don't find the answer because they look in the wrong place for the answer. And human wisdom will not give you the true meaning of life. It cannot. It's a question that human wisdom cannot answer. Yet if you search for its answer there, you will find it empty. That's Solomon's point. Solomon's church was not limited due to a lack of information on his part. Did he have a lack of information? No, he didn't have a lack of information. He didn't have a lack of information. He understood. More understanding, more grief. Notice verse number 15. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. Now, you know, in the world, there will always be shortages. There always will be wants. There will always be wars somewhere. And there will always be problems that this world has to deal with. You know why that's so? Because humans are here. That's why that's always going to be so. And nothing's going to change that. Some problems may be solved, others will take their place. And then they may come around again. But there always are going to be these types of things to deal with. As long as the earth remains, these crooked and wanting conditions cannot be made straight. Are we ever going to solve the welfare problem in our country? Never. Never. Why? Because the hard choices that have to be made to solve it, men aren't willing to make them. Are there always going to be people who are going to be poor? Yes. Are there always going to be people who are homeless? Yes. Will there always be people that are in need? Yes. All those things will always exist. Why? It's part of the package deal called life on earth. Are we going to be able to solve all the problems? Oh, we'd like to. But you see why the world will never solve the problems it has? Because it will not put God in the problem. It won't put him in there. He won't put him in the equation. And when you leave God out of the equation, you can't solve the problem. If you don't believe that's true, take a good look at our world. When God is left out of the thinking of the world, how can it solve the problems that it needs to solve? It can't. And that's what Solomon found out. Solomon says, I can't straighten what God has made crooked. I can't straighten it. You know what? Let me give you some examples. He came to realize the futility of human wisdom and its inability to straighten out the crookedness that man has made. And what is lacking cannot be numbered. You know, modern day examples. You know, John Fitzgerald Kennedy once said, human problems created by men can be solved by men. That was very catchy when he was president of the United States. But I want to tell you, that's utterly false. And I know that's utterly false because we have evidence that it's utterly false. Modern day. Unwed mothers, abortions, unwanted children. What's the answer to that? Well, the world said the answer was to pass out condoms, to give our children safe sex counseling in school, to be able to give them how to practice safe sex. That's what they said 10 years ago. In the 90s, that was the answer to the problem. Now we're 10 years past. Have we solved the problem? No. We have more of a problem. We have over 1 million abortions a year. We have unwed children, or unwed mothers. We have children who are unwanted. We have more than we've ever had. It's 200% increased. Why? We thought we had the answer 10 years ago, but that wasn't the answer. Why? Because God was left out of the problem. You're not going to stop the problem of having children who are not loved. You're not going to stop the problem of abortion until you get back to God's plan that says abstinence. Not safe sex, not counseling, abstinence. That's what God's book says. I just love to see some politician stand up and say, you know, we're making a mess of it. We're just not getting in, we're not making any progress. We're just digging a hole deeper. Why don't we get back and try it God's way? You know, I think I'd vote for somebody who would do that. If they would be willing to try what God said and not lean to human wisdom. Let me give you another example. Lying, cheating, and misleading, that's acceptable in certain situations. In certain situations, we have situation ethics today. that you can lie, you can cheat, you can mislead, as long as it gets you to the ends that you need to go by. Brethren, there's a problem there. You know, this is an election year in our country. It's supposed to be a very important time in our country, but I'll tell you something. Whether you're Republican or Democrat, no matter which one you fulfill, I tire of not being able to believe what people tell me. I get very difficult at how we teach our children that it's wrong to lie, but it's okay if you're a politician. We just expect to be lied to. We just accept it as part of life. Brethren, what's wrong with us? We have lost. I'll tell you what's wrong. We've left God out of the equation again. God says to put lying far from you, Colossians 3, verse 9. The Bible says in Matthew, the 12th chapter, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. We are supposed to be men and women of our word. When does the situation make it right for us to lie? You see, this man's wisdom. Go ahead and lie, that's okay. The ends justify the means. God says no. And you know what? On November 7th, we'll see how much wisdom we really have come to learn. Solomon, in all of his qualifications, was still unable to answer human wisdom. He came to this conclusion. Look at verse 16. I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness. I have gained more wisdom than all who before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this was also the grasping of the wind. Look at verse 18. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases in knowledge increases in sorrow. That's a powerful statement. Increased wisdom brings increased grief. Is that a true statement? Absolutely. That is a true statement. The more understanding we have, the more grief it brings. This reason is why many stay in ignorance. They don't want to know what's going on. You know why a lot of people don't get involved in the church? They don't want to know. They want to know because there might be problems. They want to deal with the problems, so they just stay in ignorance. They'll complain, they'll murmur, but they won't understand because they don't want to understand, because with that there's grief. But you know, the real truth behind this statement, in more grief, more knowledge, there is more grief. You know why that's true? Because the more we know, the more we know that we don't know. Think about it. The more knowledge I get, you know what I learn? The more I still don't know. It's never ending. God's word is full of knowledge, but the man that knows, he knows that he knows little. In comparison with God, I don't know all the answers. I don't know the end from the beginning. I don't know it without God, and I can never know it without God. But if I'm going to gain my understanding, it's going to bring me more grief. You know what? If I understand why man does what he does, it's going to bring me grief. If I understand why man does or lacks to do what he should do, it's going to bring me more grief. Why is that so? Because knowledge brings grief, because I understand that it's happening. I understand that it's real. But you know what? I still don't have the answer, do I? But I understand that I need the answer. I understand that I've got to come to an understanding. But to come to that understanding, it's going to take some effort. And you know what Solomon really says in this first chapter? He says, if you leave God out, if you leave God out of your search for wisdom, if you leave God out of the monotonous cycle of life that you seem to be in, if God is out of this picture, then your life is empty, void, and vexation of spirit, and you are striving after the wind. You know what he's saying, brethren? You're not going to find the answer to the meaning of life by looking at life per se. I can see the people are born. I can see people die. People take their place. They live and they die. I can see that. I see that happening all around me. Does that give me fulfilled? Does that give me the answer to the meaning of life? No. I can see the problems. I can see the lack of knowledge. I can see the lack of wisdom, not using God. Does that give me the meaning of life? No. It shows me something lacking. What's lacking? What's lacking is God's perspective. That's what's lacking. And brethren, that's what's lacking in life. If your life, if you're here this morning and your life has no meaning, it's simple why. It's because God's not part of it. Because without God, life has no meaning. Now, we don't like to accept that, but it's true. If I leave God out of the equation, I am going to find that life is empty. Please take your psalm books out and turn to page 301. Tonight, we're going to talk about the emptiness of things. Solomon has something to say about that in chapter 2, about how things in life produce an emptiness. But for just a minute, as we bring this lesson to a close this morning, I want to ask you a question. Does your life have meaning? Do you know why you're here? Do you know why God put you here? Do you understand that you're only going to be here for a little while? You know, there's not any of you here this morning who don't understand the brevity of life. There's not any of you that don't understand the cycle of life. You know, this very day, there are people of this congregation that were here last year, but they're not here now. That's a cycle of life. Now, if things go the way that they usually go, next year at some time, at this time next year, some of us aren't going to be here. Now, I don't say that to scare you. It's just the cycle of life. But that shouldn't worry you if God is part of your life. That shouldn't worry you. Because if God is part of your life, and you die in the Lord, your death is gain, no matter what you attributed here in life. Your death is gain. But you can't make that statement if you're not a child of God. If you're not a child of God, then you're going through life aimlessly. You're like a ship without a rudder. You have no direction. You have no guidance. And the only thing it will lead to is despair and emptiness. Now, don't learn this lesson the hard way. Solomon did. Solomon did everything life could offer. And at the end, he found that he wasted his life. Why do men not learn from the great man Solomon today? Why do they have to experience what Solomon learned the hard way? They got to learn it that way too. If you're here and you're not a Christian, you need to become one. Because it's the greatest life to live. I didn't say the easiest. I didn't say the problems will be gone. But I do say it will give you the greatest advantage to true happiness in life. Because it will put God into the equation. God is not into the equation until you become a member of his body. You must do that by hearing the word of God, believing it, repenting, confessing, and being buried in the watery grave of baptism. That puts God into the equation. That puts you in the family of God. That gives you a hope of making this life mean something. That gives you a hope of trying to bring some civil life thinking to the madness around us. God can do that. Nobody else can. If you're here and you're a child of God and you wander back into the world, you've allowed Satan again to lead you down the wrong path. You've allowed Satan to drag you back into what you came out of. Question is why, and why would you want to stay there? Come back. God will forgive you. If you'll repent, turn from the sin, God will forgive you. You know what? God has always put the ball in our court. He'll never come down and intervene for what we can do for ourselves. And if we can help you this morning in any way, we bid you.